cow. These cows are the Lord's pet animals. So we have one Sarabi cow here. Come to visit us with our deities. Now, from the Sarabi cows, one can take as much milk as one needs, and one may milk these cows as many times as he desires. In other words, the Sarabi cow can yield milk unlimitedly. Again, Prabhupada says, milk is necessary for the performance of yajna. Sages know how to use milk to elevate human society to the perfection of life. Since cow protection is recommended everywhere in the Shastras, the Brahmavadis took charge of the Sarabi cow, in which the demons were not very interested. And, you know, the thing about these pastimes is that the principles that we see here never change. Unlike stories which sometimes relate to some aspect of life and sometimes don't, the Srimad Bhagavatam, the principles hold fast eternally. You know, that's the nature that we'll see in this world. So showing that it really is the truth of existence in this world. You know. Thereafter, a horse named, thank you, Uchaisrava, which was as wide as the moon, was generated. Bali Maharaj desired to possess his horse, and Indra, the king of heaven, did not protest, for he had previously been so advised by the Supreme Person of Godhead. As the next result of churning, the king of elephants, named Airavata, was generated. This elephant was white, and with its four tusks, it defied the glories of Kailash Mountain, the glorious abode of Lord Shiva. So, we were reading last time, just to get a perspective of the, for instance, this elephant that may have appeared, that the churning of the Mandara Mountain, sitting on the back of Korma, was what, 800,000 miles, right? 800,000 miles. So this is, you know, this pastime is taking place on a mammoth, proportion. So you can imagine this mighty elephant that appears, which would be considered wonderful in stature, even to the demigods, let alone us. And of course, therefore, he gets a mention in the Bhagavad Gita. of course, in the Gita, you know, the mention amongst elephants, like Airavata. So, you know, generally reading that, we may not have a real conception of it. You know, there's an elephant named Airavata, how wonderful. You know? But, he is truly, you know, it'd be an elephant if you saw. That memory would just stay, you know, vivid within your mind for your entire life. You know, just such a wondrous sight. And the power, the might, the beauty of that white elephant with its four tusks. Thereafter, O King, eight great elephants which could go in any direction were generated. They were headed by Airavana. Eight she-elephants headed by Abramu were also generated. Report the names of the eight elephants were Airavana, Pundarik, Vamana, Kamuda, Anjana, Pushpadanta, Sarvabhauma, and Supatika. So if anyone ever gets themselves an elephant, there's some nice names for them. Or if anyone, you know, some of the mothers have a big fat baby. Generated thereafter from the great ocean were the celebrated gems Kastubha Mani and Padmaraga money. Lord Vishnu, to decorate his chest, desired to possess them. Generated next was the Parijata flower, which decorates the celestial planets. O King, as you fulfill the desires of everyone on this planet by fulfilling all ambitions, the Parijata fulfills the desires of everyone. Next, there appeared the Apsaras, who were used as prostitutes on the heavenly planets. They were fully decorated with golden ornaments and lockets and were dressed in fine and attractive clothing. The Apsaras moved very slowly in an attractive style that bewilders the inhabitants of the heavenly planets. So, you know, this term... you know, Prabhupada uses the term prostitutes on the heavenly planets. Of course, you know, in this sense, prostitute means, you know, they will associate not just with one man. You know, in social occasions, they become part of the attraction. And for the men, entertainment, and they like to enjoy in the company of very beautiful women. You can just see the nature of the heavenly planets. So, you know, so as you can see, that's why the Earth planet, and especially in Kali Yuga, you know, this Bharat Varsh is a very conducive place for spiritual life, actually, compared to the heavenly planets. You know, very distracting. And now, of course, the demigods themselves, all their bodily forms are very beautiful and attractive. And these Apsaras, you know, are irresistibly alluring, even to those, you know, beautiful demigods. So it's very hard to, you know, even comprehend. So this is, it gives us a little glimpse into the nature of the heavenly planets. And of course, you know, it also gives us a little glimpse into, you know, we know that the demigods, you know, they are devotees. But they're devotees that still have some, you know, desire for material enjoyment, you know. And so that facility is given to, you know, to very, you know, to the degree that's possible in this material world, to, you know, quite an extraordinary degree. You know, they're devotees, but, you know, this is also that they enjoy a lot of facility. So, you know, if sometimes the devotees, you know, come to ISKCON, and sometimes, you know, they also, you know, they like being devotees, but they like to enjoy a lot of material facility, they may end up in the heavenly planets. Lord Prabhupada say once, you know, so many of my disciples all want to go to the heavenly planets. Then there appeared the goddess of fortune, Rama, who is absolutely dedicated to being enjoyed by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. She appeared like electricity, surpassing the lightning that might illuminate a marble mountain. Sri means opulence, Srila Prabhupada says. Krishna is the owner of all opulences. He mentions the Bhagavad Gita 5.29. The peace formula for the world is given in Bhagavad Gita 5.29. When people know that the Supreme Lord Krishna is the supreme enjoyer, the supreme proprietor, and the most intimate well-wishing friend of all living entities, peace and prosperity will ensue all over the world. Unfortunately, the conditioned souls being placed into illusion by the external energy of the Lord want to fight with one another, and therefore peace is disturbed. The first prerequisite for peace is that all the wealth presented by Sri, the goddess of fortune, be offered to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Everyone should give up his false proprietorship over worldly possessions and offer everything to Krishna. This is the teaching of the Krishna Consciousness Movement. So, this principle, as we understand that, you know, when we when we eat food, you know, the different senses of the body, you know, they take the food and supply the food to the mouth, and then it goes to the stomach, and the whole body becomes satisfied. So, you know, if the arms or the, you know, different limbs of the body try to act independently, keeping that food for themselves, then really there'll be no happiness and satisfaction. Because we're part and parcel of the Supreme Lord, we can't actually be happy independently. Knowing that we're part and parcel of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he is the enjoyer. And when we enjoy in cooperation with the Supreme Enjoyer, we also enjoy. It's a very natural principle. You know, it appears to be like asking something too much. But, you know, for instance, a child in a family. Now, a young child, maybe 3 or 4 years old, they get to the, you know, we get the terrible twos, they call them. You know, they've been spoilt, and, you know, for 2 years, and all of a sudden they've learned how to demand things. If they don't get it, they're going to throw a tantrum and what have you. And they can really throw a whammy. So, but what they don't understand is they can't enjoy independently of the persons they depend upon for their enjoyment. That's not possible for that child to independently enjoy separately, independently from the parents. It's not possible. Impossible. Even the parents, they may say, yes, we will enjoy. But they cannot enjoy independently from the government. That's why the government accepts taxes. Because they know, you know, if each family had to get their own police, you know, protection, they had to set up their own hospital system, they have to set up their own transport. And how would that work? No one would function. So their enjoyment must be with the higher enjoyer, the government. So, you know, it seems to be asking too much, and because that's why our prisons are full, because for a lot of people it is asking too much. No, I'm the enjoyer and I'll enjoy independently. I don't need the government. But it doesn't work. So, you know, Krishna, he is a proprietor. You know, I think Mukunda Maharaj told this a joke, something like this, that he made up his own joke, that someone was saying, you know, whatever God can do, you know, I can do just as well, you know, some scientist or something. They had a challenge, you know, God and scientists. We'll both make something and see who makes the best thing. So, you know, God gets his thing, start making something. And then the scientist goes to take some of the materials, and God goes, no, get your own materials. So what's he going to pay? He's got no materials. You see, so it's like that. So, you know, it seems to be, it is the peace form, though. We become happy and peaceful, and society becomes happy and peaceful, all living entities, by enjoying in cooperation with the Supreme Enjoyer. Because of her exquisite beauty, her bodily features, her youth, her complexion, and her glories, everyone, including the demigods, the demons, and the human beings, desired her. They were attracted because she is the source of all opulences. Purport. Who in this world does not want to possess wealth, beauty, and the social respectability that come from these opulences? People generally desire material enjoyment, material opulence, and the association of aristocratic family members. Material enjoyment entails money, beauty, and the reputation they bring, which can all be achieved by the mercy of the goddess of fortune. The goddess of fortune, however, never remains alone. As indicated in the previous verse by the word Bhagavatapara, she is the property of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and is enjoyable only by him. If one wants the favour of the goddess of fortune, Mother Lakshmi, because she is by nature Bhagavatapara, one must keep her with Narayan. The devotees who always engage in the service of Narayana, can easily achieve the favour of the goddess of fortune without a doubt. But materialists who try to get the favour of the goddess of fortune only to possess her for personal enjoyment are frustrated. Theirs is not a good policy. The celebrated demon Ravana, for example, wanted to deprive Ramchandra of Lakshmi, Sita, and thus be victorious. But the result was just the opposite. Sita, of course, was taken by force by Lord Ramchandra and Ravana, and his entire material empire were vanquished. The goddess of fortune is desirable for everyone, including human beings, but one should understand that the goddess of fortune is the exclusive property of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One cannot achieve the mercy of the goddess of fortune unless one prays both to her and to the Supreme Enjoyer, the Personality of Godhead. So, you know, what's interesting here, of course, is that, you know, for thousands, millions of years, people have been reading the story of Lord Ramchandra. Most people from the Indian background, if I've spoken about the Ramayana, they'll ask me, what is the message of that book? They don't know. And not a clue. Not a clue at all. And you see all over India, you know, people, all over the world, people worshipping the goddess Lakshmi, you know, without. They've been studying the Shastras for thousands of years, generation after generation. And the main point, they're completely blind to them. It's fascinating. So this is like, for a devotee, it's common knowledge, isn't it? But it's surprising that this one point, they do not know. And of course, so, and this is the beauty of Srila Prabhupada's purports. You know, this is very simple knowledge, not difficult to understand, you know, not too philosophical, even, you know, little children could understand that. But they will read the Ramayana, they will hear from so many scholars. And this point, they'll never understand, they'll never hear, and they'll never understand. so much cheating going on, you know, people presenting themselves as big pundits, big gurus, big leaders, you know, presenting the scriptures, and this simple truth never gets to people. So, and of course, you know, on the festival days, you know, there are so many interesting stories about Lord Ramchandra, but, you know, understanding the way Prabhupada preaches and understanding what people don't know, and the main thing that, you know, when we give festival lectures, especially if there's a lot of new people, they should get this understanding, the main thing. You know, they can have so many other things as well, but, you know, someone who's, you know, when we sit to speak, you know, we feel, well, I don't have any qualification to speak. The person who should be speaking is Prabhupada. He's left his planet. But in his absence, what he would say, I'll say. You know, just passing on the message. Not that, you know, oh, I have so many interesting stories, I don't really care what Prabhupada said. I'm vastly read, and, you know, I know the scriptures so well, you know, in our pride, instead of being the humble servant, you know, in pride, we want to show our vast knowledge of the scriptures. So, you know, we should be, you know, very careful to do that, that, you know, what Prabhupada may want us to preach, that would be the main thing we preach. That is our only business, is to say the things that would be very pleasing, you know, and appropriate preaching, Srila Prabhupada. And you see that wherever Srila Prabhupada went in the world, you know, even if he was in India and there were so many pundits and so many elevated persons, he made sure they understood the basic principles, you're not this body and that, because he knew that all these pundits and, you know, that sitting out there and all these, you know, people have been, you know, studying the scriptures and passing knowledge down for generation after generation, and the basic things they got no clue. So, the King of Heaven, Indra, brought a suitable sitting place for the Goddess of Fortune. All the rivers of sacred waters, such as the Ganges and Jamuna, personified themselves, and each of them brought pure water in golden pots for Mother Lakshmi, the Goddess of Fortune. The land became a person and collected all the drugs and herbs needed for installing the deity. The cows delivered five products, namely milk, yogurt, ghee, urine and cow dung. And there's Panchamrita and there's Pancha, what's the other one? Panchagavya. And spring personified collected everything produced in spring during the months of Chaitra and Vaishakha, April and May. Oh, there it is, there, Panchagavya. So Panchagavya, the five products received from the cow, namely milk, yogurt, ghee, cow dung and cow urine, are required in all ritualistic ceremonies performed according to the Vedic directions. I know in some, you know, some Janmashtamis or some festivals, I've come here early and I've done some preparation, and I've offered all 64 items just, you know, individually, and then the rest in the actual ceremony, you know, that the public attend, just to make, you know, just to do it at least once and to know how to do it. And of course these things are mentioned, like in Rupa Goswami's Sri Janmashtami There's a book, Sri Jamashtami, something which shows you how to offer the 64 items at such festivals like Jamashtami. So cow urine and cow dung are uncontaminated, and since even the urine of and dung of a cow are important, we can just imagine how important this animal is for human civilization. Therefore, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, directly advocates Goraksha, the protection of cows. Civilized men who follow the system of Varnashram, especially those of the Vaishya class, who engage in agriculture and trade, must give protection to the cows. Unfortunately, because people in Kali Yuga are Manda, all bad, and Sumanda Mataya, misled by false conceptions of life, they are killing cows in the thousands. Therefore, they are unfortunate in spiritual consciousness, and nature disturbs them in so many ways, especially through incurable diseases like cancer, and through frequent wars and among nations. As long as human society continues to allow cows to be regularly killed in slaughterhouses, there cannot be any question of peace and prosperity. I remember one time in Perth, I'm not sure who it was, but in ISKCON, someone made these sort of like newspaper type pamphlets. About the size of a small newspaper, about peace, and it discussed this, this issue about the myth of the innocent citizen. So meaning that people start reading it and then they realize that, oh yes, because we're killing cows and so many things, that's why we're not getting peace, is because we're actually all guilty of sinful activity. Anyway, in Perth, we had them, we had, thousands of them. They were sitting there. I don't know where they got, where they come from, but they just never, ever got distributed. I don't know. It was, I think the devotees, it was only half a dozen devotees here. But anyway, one day they had this big peace rally. You know, thousands and thousands of people attending this big park in Perth. And I said, right, we're going to give out all these. I said, what you got to do, because in those days people didn't buy, anything. You just had to, we gave the books or we gave it out. I said, we've got to get in, we've got to give out every last one of them as quick as we can and disappear.
Free distribution.
Free distribution, because that's the way we distributed all our books in those days.
Yeah.
But I knew. So then you've got all these thousands and thousands of people. And they all started thinking, well, here's the peace, the pamphlet for the peace rally we're attending. And they all start reading it, What's this? The myth of the innocent citizen. Because I've been killing cows, therefore there's no peace. You never get peace. I watched from behind the tree. But, they read it. They read it, and that was their discussion, a lot of them discussion back and forth. They'll probably never forget that, when they, But,
Temple details were there?
What's that?
Temple details were there on the newspaper?
No. I don't know. We didn't print them.
Oh, yeah, it came.
They probably other temples that printed them and couldn't quite distribute them thought, oh, we better give them to Perth or something, some remote city in Australia where, I think they were a bit hesitant to give them out, so that, somehow they didn't quite get distributed. I don't know where they come from. But they didn't seem to be, devotees didn't seem to want to distribute them. I thought, okay, once, we'll give them all out. We'll make an impact. Anyway, but no one likes to hear that. That the moral of that story is, people get really angry when you say this, but it's a fact. The great sages perform the bathing ceremony of the goddess of fortune as directed in the authorized scriptures. The Gandharvas chanted all auspicious Vedic mantras, and the professional women dancers very nicely danced and sang authorized songs prescribed in the Vedas. The clouds in personified form beat various types of drums known as mridangas, panavas, murajas and anakas. They also blew conch shells and bugles known as gomukhas and played flutes and stringed instruments. The combined sound of these instruments was tumultuous. Thereafter, the great elephants from all directions carried big water jugs full of Ganges water and bathed the goddess of fortune to the accompaniment of Vedic mantras chanted by learned Brahmanas. While thus being bathed, the goddess of fortune maintained her original style with a lotus flower in her hand, and she appeared very beautiful. The goddess of fortune is the most chaste, for she does not know anyone but the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Purport. The goddess of fortune, Lakshmi, is described in this verse as Shriyam, which means that she has six opulences: wealth, strength, influence, beauty, knowledge, and renunciation. These opulences are received from the goddess of fortune. Lakshmi is addressed here as Devi, the goddess, because in Vaikuntha she supplies all opulences to the Supreme Personality of Godhead and his devotees, who in this way enjoy natural life in the Vaikuntha planets. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is pleased with his consort, the goddess of fortune, who carries a lotus flower in her hand. Mother Lakshmi is described in this verse as Sati, the supremely chaste, because she never diverts her attention from the Supreme Personality of Godhead to anyone else. So these opulences. Wealth, you know, when we do the marriage ceremony, we say, may Vishnu, may walk through the seven circles, may Vishnu lead you to strength, and may Vishnu lead you to power. You know, power means this influence. You know, the strength, one needs, you know, good health, and power, you know, when I say that wedding, I say it in the sense of, you know, influence. That's really its meaning there. Otherwise, strength and power seem to be the same thing. But you know, that you know, the ability to, it is a type of power to influence others, as well as having personal body strength, but to influence others. That's, you know, another type of power or strength. You know, so persons, you know, in the Pancha, Jagna, you know, where they worship Ganesh, the sun, Lakshmi, Ganesh, the sun, Shiva, Durga, and Vishnu. Ganesh representing that power over the masses, or influence. People want that. He represents that. So that is coming from goddess Lakshmi. Is one of the opulences. And so people crave that. Politicians crave that, you know, that influence, the ability to, you know, in Australia, they don't have that. Every 6 months they kick out the Prime Minister because he has no influence. He cannot influence even his own cabinet, let alone the whole country. But so one cannot maintain position in government without influence. You know, and that is a blessing from goddess of fortune, as well as wealth and strength, beauty, knowledge, and renunciation. Mm. So, you know, and of course, it's also, you know, we sometimes also know it as fame, you know, which is a, you know, you know, another way to present that, you know, one's fame or influence. You know, Krishna's fame, Krishna is considered non-different from his fame. So his Bhagavad Gita is considered very famous. So it's very influential. So, yes, it's Lakshmi. So, text 15. The ocean, which is a source of all valuable jewels, supplied the upper and lower portions of a yellow silken garment. The predominating deity of the water, Varuna, presented flower garlands surrounded by six-legged bumblebees, drunken with honey. How many legs do bumblebees usually have?
Six.
Six? What do they have? Spiders? Arachnids have eight. Insects have six. Do they have four? Do bumblebees have four legs?
One verse, like, King Kutkina, one verse, he considered himself as a bumblebee.
Yeah.
You know, going to the Lord's feet of the Lord.
Yeah.
So the Sanskrit word used is Shat Pada. Shat means six, Pada.
He had six legs.
Yeah, like, so I was just thinking. Yeah, here the Shat Pada,
Vasudev, call him on the phone. He's just sitting over there. We'll have to call him on the phone to get his attention. We need someone who's studied biology, lad.
Oh, I can
say
that.
Yeah. So just three pairs of legs.
Is it?
Yeah, three pairs.
So that's so it's usual to have six legs.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So, now here, this is interesting. When bathing the deity in the Abhishek ceremony with various liquids such as milk, honey, yogurt, ghee, etc., it is customary to supply yellow garments. In this way, the Abhishek ceremony with the goddess of fortune was performed according to the regular Vedic principles. You know, I remember once we did have it, and you can taste it in the drink. So, you know.
You stopped, is it?
Yeah, I decided. We only used a little bit, but it's very strong. You know, so for the sake of the guess, just in case someone says, what's that strange aftertaste? You imagine the health authorities coming down on us for that one. I went to the Hare Krishna temple. Because a lot of people won't understand.
So at the moment we don't
Generally we don't do that, yeah. But if we do, which on some occasion we do it, but we make sure that it's done slightly separately with the Pancha Gavya, and then that the Panchamrita is done separately as well. So.
With the previous purport as Mother Lakshmi giving the opulences to the Lord.
Yes.
How do we understand? Because we always say that the Lord is the Shaktiman, he is the energetic and he has the energy. And so here it seems to be like she is giving it. Or is it like an expansion?
Yeah, the energy and the energetic, they're one. So, they're absolute. The source of the energy, the control of the energy, the enjoy of the energy, and the energy itself. They're different, but at the same time, they're on an absolute platform. They're one. You won't see one without the other. At the same time, although they're one, equally on the absolute platform, and one in the sense of it is the one unit. Still, there's a difference. As we know, there's a difference between the sun you know, or the energy, you can't say that the sunshine is exactly the same as the sun glow, because we can tolerate the sunshine in our in our room, but we couldn't tolerate the presence of the sun glow. So but you know, Krishna's energies, they fulfill all the Lord's desires automatically. You know, they fulfill His will automatically. So, although in one sense, you know, He's the enjoyer and the controller of the Shakti, but you know, he doesn't necessarily have to, you know, be giving commands or giving payments or facilitating their service or you know, distracting himself from his enjoyable pastimes. His energies literally just fulfill his will automatically. In that sense, Lakshmi is giving. So, you know, she is giving automatically and automatically with love. So, of free will, you know, out of love and free will. So, she's not like a machine, you know, that you create to produce something, and it produces something. You know, a machine doesn't give you anything. You know, you control the machine, and it, you know, you get, it produces something as you control it. If we could make a machine, and once you made it, it just keeps giving you things that different independently, you know. See, so Lakshmi is, you know, Krishna's Shaktis act like that. You know, they're actually independently giving with love and with their own intuitive creativity, and in such a way that even Krishna is surprised. You know, Lakshmi is creating these wonderful, you know, facility in the spiritual world that even Krishna is amazed. You know, what to speak of Lakshmi? You know, in the pastimes of Krishna, you know, even Krishna, he was amazed at looking at the way material energy, you know, was performing, you know, its functions and bewildering all the living entities. He was even surprised at the way the material energy is, you know, doing. So it's doing so wonderfully that, you know, he's like, well, you know, what to speak of the spiritual energy? So, you know, they're giving, they're giving. It's not mechanical. And yet, that spiritual energy is he himself. It's his own energy. It's not anyone else's, it's actually him. It's another, you know, it's said that actually all the residents of the spiritual world, including Lakshmi, are expansion of Krishna. Different places that are stated. Mother Yashoda, the cowherd boys, Gopi. All expansions of Krishna. Prabhupada says, what does that mean? It means they're expansions of his energy. So really they're all just Krishna. So, you know, in one sense, does that mean no one will ever give Krishna anything? Because he's alone? There's only Krishna, there is no other, so you never get any gifts. No. He is so wonderful that he actually, although everything is him, people are giving him eternally like that. So they are giving. They are giving. So that's the difficult part, that, you know, for the impersonalists to, you know, understand. They understand how everything is one, which it is. But how, and then they say God is great and he is the greatest. So how Krishna is great, we understand, oh, see how he uses his energies, oh, then you see how great he is. Like that. That is, when you see, otherwise you cannot understand the greatness of Krishna until you understand. Here is Lakshmi, Krishna's own energy, that she is independent, she is giving to God, continuing, he is accepting from another person and enjoying that loving reciprocation. And that's a wonderful mystical display of his energies. Mm. So both, we can probably shut that in. Because gradually you get a lot of children come in. Mm.
I think it's a class at 4 o'clock today.
Where's that?
In the theatre at the Bainaraya Mataji.
Oh, yeah. If you want to go, you can. It's up to you, because I know you do a great...
No. I think this is for people who are doing the fast funeral service.
Oh, okay. Right. Yeah.
It's not for everyone.
Mm. Right. Oh, we picked the right room then. Yeah. Yeah, so some very deep discussions here, from six-legged bumblebees to the Lord's multifarious energies. There's so much in the Bhagavatam. You know, it's actually, doesn't matter how many times you read the Bhagavatam, there is so much there, it is so deep that... you know, it's just very, very enjoyable, very pleasurable.
Very simple to understand. It's not like to... anybody can understand.
It is. The beauty is, if you follow Prabhupada's, teachings, it is very easy to understand when you just, you know, take it through, you know, the acharyas. That's right, yeah. Therefore, you know, we should never be proud of, we should always just try and be, as Prabhupada would call it, the peon. You know, the peon is the messenger. The beauty of the Bhagavatam is that while you're delivering that message, you can't help but, you know, become a bit blissful and enjoy the whole process, you know, and relish it, especially, you know, in the association of other devotees. So, you know, you see, Srila Prabhupada is a messenger, but it's not like a postman. You know, he would say that's all we really have to do is be a messenger, but at the same time, we get to carry the message and hear the message. That's the difference. So, you know, quite often the postman, but, you know, the special privilege here is that we're a messenger, but we actually get to know the message, just like Uddhava. And therefore, you know, you see that as Srila Prabhupada would present the Srimad Bhagavatam, you know, you could see he was always in that mood of just being the humble messenger, but you could see he couldn't help but get caught up in the wonder of the Bhagavatam. You know, when you listen to the Prabhupada speaking the Krishna book, you know, so literally he's speaking it, and what he spoke they put in the book. You know. When he was speaking how the gopis feeling separation from Krishna, as he tried to speak that, he started crying, and then he stopped the dictaphone. But you can hear, and then he started up again. You can hear his, you know, compose himself. And I was listening to a tape this morning how Prabhupada was describing how Krishna was speaking to Nanda Maharaj during the Govardhan Puja, taking the atheistic Kama Mamamsa philosophy, and Krishna is saying to his father, no, if there is a God, then, you know, this would be the case, things would be like this, you know. Anyway, so Prabhupada laughed, you know. It's like, Krishna's God, and he's saying, if there is a God, you know. So you can't help but see the humour of Krishna, and, you know, the whole, you know, it's quite a, you know, funny. Yeah. And sometimes, you know, in... I think it was Canada, was that Montreal? Yeah. He went there, he was doing an arrival address, and he was just going to explain how merciful Lord Chaitanya is and how wonderful it is that, you know, everyone has taken up this... he'd only spoke for about a minute and a half, and he just started crying. Right? And he couldn't speak the words, and he said, thank you, and he just stopped. So... you know, that. So therefore, really our duty is just to be a messenger and present that. But the Bhagavatam, being the messenger of the Bhagavatam, is something special. You can't help but get a little bit of a nectar on the way, you know. It's highly contagious. It's a wonderful process. So Vishvakarma, one of the Prajapatis, supplied varieties of decorated ornaments. The goddess of learning, Sarasvati, supplied a necklace. Lord Brahma supplied a lotus flower, and the inhabitants of Nagaloka supplied earrings. So that's nice. Sarasvati supplied a necklace. Of course, you know, we can only, you know, begin to you know, imagine the craftsmanship of that necklace. You know, something extraordinary. Because yeah, Mother Sarasvati is, you know, the goddess of learning, which includes, you know, the fine arts, and so that would be a nice contribution. Yeah, and the inhabitants of Nagaloka supplied earrings. So obviously, you know, as we get a lot of valuable gems from deep down in the earth, so they must come across because they live in the sort of lower regions, so they must come across some particularly stunning gems in their travels in those subterranean regions. Thereafter, Mother Lakshmi, the goddess of fortune, having been properly celebrated with an auspicious ritualistic ceremony, began moving about, holding in her hand a garland of lotus flowers, which was surrounded by humming bees. Similarly, smiling with shyness, her cheeks decorated by her earrings, she looked extremely beautiful. The goddess of fortune, Mother Lakshmiji, accepted the ocean of milk as her father, but she perpetually rests on the bosom of Narayan. She offers benedictions even to Lord Brahma and other living entities in this material world, yet she is transcendental to all material qualities. Although she appeared to have been born of the ocean of milk, she immediately resorted to her eternal place on the bosom of Narayan. So, you know, the goddess Lakshmi, so she's actually, you know, a spiritual personality, although generally she's counted among the demigods as Vishnu is. And Sarasvati, you know, she's the wife of Lord Brahma. But as Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati points out in the Brahma Samhita, Divya Sarasvati, you know, she is a transcendental personality who awards spiritual realization. So they have their material shadow aspect that people understand them, you know, Sarasvati and goddess Lakshmi, spiritual personalities, but they also present, you know, this material aspect for those who see them, you know, on that level. So, you know, one sense they're sisters. Sometimes Prabhupada refers to them like sisters. You quite often see, you know, Sarasvati, Lakshmi, Ganesh sometimes, they, like that. In one sense, considered to be children of Durga, aren't they, in one sense? Is it? But,
is it written in one of the purports?
Yeah, Bhagavatam.
Shabhose.
What's that?
Shabhose.
Yeah, that, you know, Shiva and Durga have three famous, they have famous children, you know, Kartika, Ganesh, Sarasvati and Lakshmi, I think all of those. Sometimes they're considered to be, you know, they're in the sense that they're, you know, their material shadow aspect appears to be, you know, productive, you know, therefore the children of Shiva and Durga, but, you know, there's even a spiritual Ganesh, isn't there?
Yeah, there's
Yeah, what's that?
Environment.
Yeah.
There's a sense,
it's really the Krishna kidnaps Rukmini. There's a sense. Four children, Durga. So Ganesh, Kartikeya, and Lakshmi, and that's it. Yeah. So they're considered, you know, the children of Durga, as Prabhupada's pointing out. That's how generally people see them.
Sometimes the Saraswati is considered the daughter of Brahma also.
Yes, that's right. They do appear to have, you know, other appearances at different times and what have you. But so, you know, their pastimes facilitate that if people want to see them as just material demigods, that's possible. I don't know all the stories involved, but, you know, generally people accept those four personalities as the children of Durga and Shiva. But, you know, we also understand that through other pastimes that, you know, Sarasvati and Divya Sarasvati and Lakshmi, Sri, are actually the spiritual Shaktis of the personality of Godhead in their true form. So, you know, different pastimes reveal both those aspects. So, but generally for materialists, that, you know, and most, you know, I've asked, again, I love asking the Indian community these questions, even among the devotees. none of them know, you know, like they, I try and find out, you know, that what they know about these things, and that's just a complete void. Apart from the references, like we've just read, they've never heard anything, but they just accept, you know, something that's passed down from generation. Oh, yeah, the children of Durga. And someone says, oh, they're spiritual. Oh, okay, yeah, well, there's a Vedic reference. That, you know, even amongst the devotees, there's just like a vacuum. But, you know, from the Brahma Samhita, we, you know, Śrīla Bhaktisiddhanta's discussion on Sarasvati, we do understand there is a material aspect in this original spiritual aspect of the same person. And the different pastimes tend to allow people to think whichever way they want to.
And then now Lakshmi's appearance in this material world happens in this way.
Mm.
Like she is eternally present in the spiritual world, but she appears in the material world after the channel.
Yeah.
Is it all?
Okay. Yeah. And therefore, you know, for, you know, even there, you know, see a lot of people see Vishnu or Narayan, you know, as a demigod. Lakshmi, the goddess of fortune, you know, his wife. But so they might see, you know, Lakshmi as the consort of Vishnu or Narayan, but the daughter of Durga. But yes, even these Kastuba gems, you know, they're eternally, you know, the lords. You see sometimes in the Krishna book where, is it the Pancha, is it Panchajanya, or there's a gem that was in the conch shell demon. Krishna killed that demon and got the gem. You know, that's his eternal gem. And then, there's a whole pastime with that as to, because then I think it got passed to, I think it ended up with Balaram, he gave it to Radharani, he gave it back together. There's a whole, anyway, we'll get to that. But, Krishna's flute. It's eternal, Krishna's flute. We know that Krishna is never without his flute. But that's not completely correct, because sometimes the gopis steal his flute. Therefore, Prabhupada sometimes speaks of the form of Shyamasundara, the form of Krishna in his threefold bending form, playing his flute with a peacock feather, as a symbolic representation of Krishna. So he would say that. Not that, so symbolic representation meaning that, when we think of Krishna, we should think of him like that, eternally with his flute. That is a proper way to think of him, not without his flute. But with a little bit more understanding, deeper, that although his flute is eternally his, it sometimes gets stolen. Now, how can someone steal from God? How can he lose his flute? How can, so that you can't tell people. So therefore, what is a symbolic representation of Krishna? Standing there playing the flute. Now, you can't tell them that someone, don't understand. So, Prabhupada speaks, and similarly, devotees, we understand that the symbolic representation of Lord Narayan, Vishnu, as he has his Kastuba jewel, and Lakshmi is always present. The symbolic represent, that's how we should always think of him. But then a little deeper understanding means that, there's some pastimes associated with these gems and like that. And that takes a lot more. That when we get into the Krishna book, we'll contemplate, as we're discussing there, how is it that Lakshmi is giving Krishna, so it takes a little bit more contemplation of that. But, So we're talking about Lakshmi. Her two breasts, which were symmetrical and nicely situated, were covered with sandalwood pulp and kumkum powder, and her waist was very thin. As she walked here and there, her ankle bells jingling softly, she appeared like a creeper of gold. While walking among the Gandharvas, Yakshas, Asuras, Siddhas, Charanas, and denizens of heaven, Lakshmi Devi, the goddess of fortune, was scrutinizingly examining them, but she could not find anyone naturally endowed with all good qualities. None of them was devoid of faults, and therefore she could not take shelter of any of them. The goddess of fortune, Lakshmi Devi, having been generated from the ocean of milk, was the daughter of the ocean. Thus she was allowed to select her own husband in a Svayamvara ceremony. She examined every one of the candidates, but she could not find anyone suitably qualified to be her shelter. In other words, Narayan, the natural husband of Lakshmi, cannot be superseded by anyone in this material world. And, I've sometimes meditated like this, on Sankirtan, that, when you go out and you're selling books or liberating Lakshmi, as we say, you come across many, people in this world, and you know, sometimes when you look at people from a material perspective, they can be a little alluring. But you know, if you have the form of Krishna within your mind, you know, that form of beauty and perfection, and then you're looking, you see there's no allurement, because you think there's just no one really competes in any way, shape or form, you know, to Krishna, especially standing beside the goddess of Lakshmi, you know, that you know, the gopi, you know, Radharani, you know, there's just no scene, no matter where you go in the city or, you know, around the world, you know, just, you know, there's nothing that can compare to just, you know, looking and thinking, oh, now there's Radharani and Krishna sitting under that beautiful, you know, in a swing and a tree, and, you know, like that, you know, you imagine, you know, that's not that scene. You're just left wanting, you know, whatever you look at. So, you know, when you have those pictures in your head, as we do, because we look at the books, and then you compare that everywhere you go in the world, you think, I just wish I could just see Radharani and Lakshmi just in their beautiful natural setting, but, you know, there's just nothing in the world that compares, and nothing can attract like that. So, you know, these descriptions from the Bhagavatam, they're to give us a standard of beauty which we should always search out for. And as we search out for, we'll see there's nothing in this world that compares. You know, so they're actually, you know, they give us great spiritual strength, actually, for, you know, to be renounced in this world, because there's something better. The goddess of fortune, examining the assembly, thought in this way: someone who has undergone great austerity has not yet conquered anger. Someone possesses knowledge, but he has not conquered material desires. Someone is a very great personality, but he cannot conquer lusty desires. Even a great personality depends on something else. How then can he be the supreme controller? So in this way, you know, when you have that standard of the personality of Godhead, you know, an actual great personality, you know, you're looking somewhere, and you know that you're just not going to find it. Everything will leave you short. I remember when I was on the phone farm, and I was managing there, Narayan Maharaj, who was sort of sweeping the world with popularity, he came and did a big festival at a property right next to the farm. There was some accommodation, a farm up in underground. And some of the devotees were saying to me, you know, come and see. And I'm thinking, am I going to see Prabhupada there? Because if I'm not, I'll be disappointed. You know, you can't, I know I'll be disappointed. I already have Prabhupada, you know, do you think I'm looking for something? I had no interest, even to go and see, even to look, and no interest. And so it's like this. You know that there's, you're going to be let down. So, you know, we have these, so I never went, but they all did, but I don't know why. You know, to me, I could never understand it, because it's like, you know, if, you know, say, you know, a man is married, and his friends come up to him and say, oh, she's a beautiful girl, you know, come and see. He's saying, I have my wife, you know, completely, no, come and see. You know, would you, it's wrong, you know, there's something very wrong about it, you know, just to go and look, there's something very wrong, yeah. So, and of course, you know, in this way, you know, we understand that this is also the strength of our, you know, not being allured by the material energy, is that, you know, we don't want to go chasing happiness in this world that's different from the happiness we're getting from Krishna and Chaitanya and Prabhupada and the spiritual masters and the Vaishnavas. It'd be just wrong, you know, that they're giving us so much happiness and we're saying, no, I'm looking here. You know, there's something very wrong about that. Krishna used that argument also with Nanda Maharaj, saying that, you know, as you know, to give up one's profession, you know, because everything is there in one's natural profession as Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, is also unchaste, just like a wife, you know, looking elsewhere or something. You know, it's just as unchaste to give up your profession. You know. So, you know, people with strong principles, you know, they don't give up those things which they know of, you know, they're great benedictions and wonderful, and it's wrong to even look elsewhere at something inferior for ones that there may be some inferior type of sense gratification there. So, this is saying, someone may possess full knowledge of religion but still not be kind to all living entities. In someone, whether human or demigod, there may be renunciation, but that is not the cause of liberation. Someone may possess great power and yet be unable to check the power of eternal time. Someone else may have renounced attachment to the material world, yet he cannot compare to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, no one is completely free from the influence of the material modes of nature. Prabhupada mentions in this purport that one must develop a sense of loving Vasudev. Vasudev Savam Iti Samahatma Sudurva. The sign of devotee is that he is a friend to everyone. A devotee will never allow a poor animal to be killed in the name of religion. This is the difference between a superficially religious person and a devotee of the Supreme Person of Godhead. We may find in many great heroes in history, but they could not escape the cruel hands of death. Even the greatest hero cannot escape the ruling power of the Supreme Personality of Godhead when he comes as death. That is described by Krishna himself, Mrityushava Harashchaham. Translation. Someone may have longevity but not have auspiciousness or good behavior. Someone may have both auspiciousness and good behavior, but the duration of his life is not fixed. Although such demigods as Lord Shiva have eternal life, they have inauspicious habits like living in crematoriums. And even if others are well qualified in all respects, they are not devotees of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That's an interesting statement about Lord Shiva, isn't it? You know, it's we see, you know, we have described that Lord Shiva, you know, in one sense is non different from the Lord himself. He's a, you know, the Lord personally expands as Lord Shiva, but the Lord doesn't have to hang around crematoriums. Lord Shiva does. The Lord doesn't have to. So therefore he's in a superior position. So, he doesn't have to, you know, wear the necklaces of skulls and so many different things. All his, you know, all Krishna's pastimes are just, you know, spotless. Imbued with so much attractiveness. Sukadeva Goswami continued, in this way, after full deliberation, the goddess of fortune accepted Mukunda as her husband because although he is independent and not in want of her, he possesses all transcendental qualities and mystic powers and is therefore the most desirable. See, so as we described before in this discussion of Lakshmi, Lakshmi's giving.
Yeah.
But he doesn't need to accept. So in another sense, you know, no one can give to the Lord. He's self-sufficient. At the same time, she's giving, because he's accepting and reciprocating with love. You know, they're reciprocations of loving transactions. She's a devotee. He's completely independent. So this is also, you know, now, for those so-called spiritualists, you know, who turn, you know, the phrase Dirigen Orion. Who was that? Was that Dirigen Orion? You know, what's that?
Vivekananda.
What's that?
Vivekananda.
Yeah. And it's taken up by others after him as well. But now these personalities are considered great Sanskrit scholars and great knowers of the Vedas. You know, very, very elevated scholars. But just see the great discrepancy here. You know, Lakshmi herself is testifying that, you know, he is the goddess of fortune, desires to serve him, yet he is so far above even requiring the service of the goddess of Lakshmi, he doesn't require that. How can we say such a person is poor? That they're so well situated that if the goddess of fortune herself desires to be your eternal servant, it's not required. And they're saying, Dirigen Orion. Orion as a pauper. And these are supposed to be great scholars and pundits. You know? What have they understood? Approaching the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Goddess of Fortune placed upon his shoulders the garland of newly grown lotus flowers, which was surrounded by humming bees searching for honey. Then, expecting to get a place on the bosom of the Lord, she remained standing by his side, her face smiling in shyness. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is the Father of the three worlds, and his bosom is the residence of Mother Lakshmi, the Goddess of Fortune, the proprietor of all opulences. The Goddess of Fortune, by her favorable and merciful glance, can increase the opulence of the three worlds along with their inhabitants and their directors, the demigods. So just by a little glance from the Goddess of Fortune, even the demigods are desiring that benedictory glance, even the greatest of demigods, such as her elevated position. And she's residing on the chest of the Lord. desiring to. So, purport, according to the desire of Lakshmi Devi, the Goddess of Fortune, the Supreme Person of Godhead made his bosom her residence so that, by her glance, she could favour everyone, including the demigods and ordinary human beings. In other words, since the Goddess of Fortune stays on the bosom of Narayan, she naturally sees any devotee who worships Narayan. When the Goddess of Fortune understands that a devotee is in favour of devotional service to Narayan, she is naturally inclined to bless the devotee with all opulences. The Karmis try to receive the favour and mercy of Lakshmi, but because they are not devotees in Orion, their opulence is flickering. The opulence of devotees who are attached to the service of Orion is not like the opulence of Karmis. The opulence of devotees is as permanent as the opulence of Orion himself. So sometimes devotees become very opulent because of, you know, the nature of their service. You know, some Some devotees, you know, they're being favoured by the goddess of fortune because of their service, and some are being favoured by the Lord's illusory potency. Lord Nityananda, Gaura Kishore Das Babaji, he would say that sometimes Lord Nityananda will give benedictions in such a way if people are associating with devotees in a very pretentious way, you know, for the sake of fame and influence. And, you know, when they get the fame and influence, then as devotees, they will get so much facility and, you know, wealth, and, you know, even within ISKCON. But Gaura Kishore Das Babaji says sometimes Lord Nityananda will favour them with such opulence, so they go away. they get that opulence, and then they go away. So, you know, but then again, you know, we see that in the Battle of Kurukshetra, Arjun, who's known as Dhananjaya, the conqueror of wealth, you know, to fund the Battle of Kurukshetra, to fund any war, you've got to feed all the soldiers, millions and millions, you know, soldiers. Feed the elephants, make the weapons, a lot of money. And they also had to get immense wealth before the Battle of Kurukshetra, which they did. And of course, these are all blessings of the goddess of fortune, because of their, you know, if they require facility in the service of the Lord. We see Srila Prabhupada, he turned 40 rupees into $40 million with the properties, and, you know, meant for the service of the Lord. That's a favour of the goddess of fortune. It's unheard of, you know, materially. So in 10 years, 12 years.
And at that age.
Mm. So, and that opulence is permanent. No one can take that opulence from Prabhupada. It's permanent. The inhabitants of Gandharva Loka, but, you know, as we see in the pastimes of Ravana, they can take the Maya form of opulence, but not the actual, you know. The benedictions of the goddess of fortune is eternal for the, you know, the devotees. But if someone takes the opulence from ISKCON, sometimes people steal a temple or two here and there. They get the real thing, the real opulence. Whether they're getting the real benediction of Lakshmi is questionable. The inhabitants of Gandharva Loka and Charana Loka then took the opportunity to play their musical instruments, such as conch shells, bugles and drums. They began dancing and singing along with their wives. Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, the great Angira, and similar directors of universal management showered flowers and chanted mantras indicating the transcendental glories of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. All the demigods, along with the Prajapatis and their descendants, being blessed by Lakshmiji's glance upon them, were immediately enriched with good behaviour and transcendental qualities. Thus they were very much satisfied. O King, because of being neglected by the goddess of fortune, the demons and Rakshasas were depressed, bewildered and frustrated, and thus they became shameless. Next appeared Varuni, the lotus-eyed goddess who controls drunkards. With the permission of the Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna, the demons, headed by Bali Maharaj, took possession of this young girl. O King, thereafter, while the sons of Kashyapa, both demons and demigods, were engaged in churning the ocean of milk, a very wonderful male person appeared. He was strongly built, his arms were long, stout and strong, his neck, which was marked with three lines, resembled a conch shell. His eyes were reddish and his complexion was blackish. He was very young, he was garlanded with flowers, and his entire body was fully decorated with various ornaments. He was dressed in yellow garments and wore brightly polished earrings made of pearls. The tips of his hair were anointed with oil, and his chest was very broad. His body had all good features. He was stout and strong like a lion. He was decorated with bangles. In his hand he carried a jug filled to the top with nectar. This person was Dhanvantari, a plenary portion of a plenary portion of the Lord himself. He was conversant with the science of medicine, and as one of the demigods, he was permitted to take a share in sacrifices. Purport: Srila Madhvacharya remarks, Dhanvantari, who was carrying the jug containing nectar, was a plenary incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but although he was very strong, the Asuras were able to take the jug of nectar from his hands. Yes. Dhanvantari. Yeah, that's right. They get the blessings for the medical
thing.
Understanding and potency. Mm.
Yeah, and in one of the lectures we said that when we take the medicine as well, and the Lord sanctions it, the medicine also will not work.
That's right, yeah. That's right. So we say, Sri Vishnu, Sri Vishnu, Sri Vishnu. Mm. Upon seeing Dhanvantari carrying the jug of nectar, the demons, desiring the jug and its contents, immediately snatched it away by force. When the jug of nectar was carried off by the demons, the demigods were morose, thus they sought the shelter at the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Hari. When the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who always desires to fulfill the ambitions of his devotees, saw that the demigods were morose, he said to them, "Do not be aggrieved. By my own energy, I shall bewilder the demons by creating a quarrel among them. In this way, I shall fulfill your desire to have the nectar." O King, a quarrel then arose among the demigods. Who would first get the nectar first? Who would get the nectar first? Each of them said, "You cannot drink it first. I must drink it first. Me first, not you." Report. This is the symptom of demons. The first concern of a non-devotee is how to enjoy his personal sense gratification at once, whereas the devotee's first concern is to satisfy the Lord. This is the distinction between the non-devotee and the devotee. In this material world, since most people are non-devotees, they regularly compete, fight, disagree, and war among themselves, for everyone wants to enjoy and satisfy his own senses. Therefore, unless such demons become Krishna conscious and are trained to satisfy the senses of the Lord, there can be no question of peace in human society or any society, even that of the demigods. The demigods and devotees, however, always surrender to the lotus feet of the Lord, and thus the Lord is always anxious to satisfy their ambitions. While the demons fight to satisfy their own senses, devotees engage in devotional service to satisfy the senses of the Lord. The members of the Krishna consciousness movement must be alert in regard to this point, and then their preaching of the Krishna consciousness movement will be successful. So now, Srila Prabhupada, you know, he explains this point. He says, you know, friend, he gives the example, everyone likes to dance, but if you dance for your own enjoyment, you'll not become satisfied. But if you dance for the enjoyment of Krishna, you become satisfied. And he says, when you dance with Krishna, both Krishna and you enjoy it. Krishna enjoys it, and you enjoy it. So both dancing like that. So, you know, it's easy to understand. You know, if someone's saying, I'll dance by myself and I'll get all the pleasure myself. But actually, if you dance, you know, very friendly with someone, and it enhances the whole enjoyment of it, you both enjoy. No one thinks, why should I dance with you? You'll get half the enjoyment. You know, people, it doesn't make sense, does it? So enjoyment is like that. It's when you actually, you know, when you enjoy with someone, you both equally enjoy. But they're thinking, oh, we give to Krishna, he's enjoying, what about me? But Krishna's thinking, no, we'll enjoy together. You do it with me means we'll enjoy it together. Like we'll dance together, we'll both enjoy. You know, like that. Imagine dancing with Krishna in the moonlight, you know, by the Jamuna. I'll be in that. Yeah. That's enjoyment, you know. Better than being in peak hour traffic on a, you know, on the West Gate Bridge, isn't it? You know, on a 41 degree day. So
when we are dancing in the temple, running around and doing all kinds of twisting and turning, are we dancing with Krishna or are we dancing for ourselves?
Well, let's hope we're dancing with Krishna. It should be for Krishna's pleasure. Devotees should dress for Krishna's pleasure, dance for Krishna's pleasure. That's the proper way.
So the dancing should be like a visually pleasing rather than...
Well, you know, dancing, therefore, you know, there are some guidelines, you know, with Prabhupada, you know, that, you know, we don't curtail natural ecstasy. But, you know, we don't encourage sort of egotistical showing off. You know, that's not necessarily for the pleasure of the devotees and Krishna, but, you know, more for one's pride and attention. So, you know. But, you know, these things take a little bit of... everything should be done... under the guidance of devotees, you know, so that things are done properly. You know. Otherwise, everything without the guidance of mature devotees, you know, there's a danger there that it may be done in the wrong way. You know. So the main thing is to do things under the guidance. You know, we don't want to be, you know, dancing is a very spontaneous, you know, ecstatic symptom. You don't want to, you know, stifle that with too many rules and regulations. But at what time?
Okay.
But at the same time, you know, when someone is within the assembly of devotees acting very strongly for their own subtle sense gratification, that stifles ecstasy. So, therefore, there has to be, you know, a little balance.
Like in a Ratha Yatra, when we have done, that there are dances on the stage, that appears to be the dancing for the pleasure of the audience.
Yeah, which means for the pleasure of Krishna.
Yes.
Yeah, they want, you know, that they want that when people, you know, they will sit and hear the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra for a long, long time because visually it is very attractive as well. And so they'll join in and it's not too crazy for them, you know, and what have you. So... you know, for the sake of attracting especially people who may, you know, the whole thing of chanting Hare Krishna may be a bit, you know, some people just don't like anything foreign. You know, if it's not the football anthem, they're just wondering why you're singing it in the first place, you know, what is wrong with you, you know. To be a little kind, we try and, you know, make it a very enjoyable experience for them, and then they think, look, I don't understand this at all, but I love it. Then that's okay. So some of the demons said, all the demigods have taken part in churning the ocean of milk. Now, as everyone has an equal right to partake in any public sacrifice according to the eternal religious system, it is befitting that the demigods now have a share of the nectar. O king, in this way, the weaker demons forbade the stronger demons to take the nectar. Purport. desiring to take the nectar, those among the demons who were less strong spoke in favour of the demigods. The weaker daitas naturally pleaded on behalf of the demigods to stop the stronger daitas from drinking the nectar without sharing. In this way, disagreement and trouble arose and they forbade one another to drink the nectar. Very cunning, isn't it? The Supreme Personality of Godhead Vishnu, who can counteract any unfavourable situation, then assumed the form of an extremely beautiful woman. This incarnation as a woman, Mohini Murti, was most pleasing to the mind. Her complexion resembled in colour a newly grown blackish lotus, and every part of her body was beautifully situated. Her ears were equally decorated with earrings, her cheeks were very beautiful, her nose was raised, and her face full of youthful luster. Her large breast made her waist seem very thin. Attracted by the aroma of her face and body, bumblebees hummed around her, and thus her eyes were restless. Her hair, which was extremely beautiful, was garlanded with mallika flowers. Her attractively constructed neck was decorated with a necklace and other ornaments. Her arms were decorated with bangles, her body was covered with a clean sari, and her breasts seemed like islands in an ocean of beauty. Her legs were decorated with ankle bells because of the movements of her eyebrows as she smiled with shyness and glanced over the demons. All the demons were saturated with lusty desires, and every one of them desired to possess her. Purport. Because of the Supreme Lord's assuming the form of a beautiful woman to rouse the lusty desires of the demons, a description of her complete beauty is given here. So of course we understand that Vishnu, in this form of Mohini Murti, it is Vishnu. It is our Lord. It's God. We have to keep that in the back of our mind. It's God appearing as Mohini Murti. When God appears as a very attractive woman, there's nothing that can compare. Yeah. And so, you know, these demigods. So that's it. So kind of part one in the old system of books. So next week we'll take up chapter 8, right? Yeah. So next week we'll do chapter 9, yeah? Which is we'll leave it there because that's a lot. It's a wonderful meditation. So next week we're going to do have a look at the Lord incarnation Mohini Murti, that how that pastime unfolds in chapter 9.
This unit is filled with chapter.
What's that?
This unit.
Yeah.
Is filled with chapter.
We'll do the whole. We'll do
the whole
canto. There's Gajendra pastime, and this whole pastime right up, and then there's a little bit of the Priyavrata. The austerity performed by the deity. It's pretty much the whole thing is very much connected. So, I'm still deciding whether to just do because there are so many units of examination and within the 10th and 11th canto. That I'm tempted to just do one examination on the 8th canto and then just move into the 9th canto, because when we get to the 11th canto and there's about the disappearance of the Yadu dynasty, there's the Avaduta Brahmanas, there's 10th canto, 12th, so I'm sure we'll get plenty of exams and essays out of that. So I think my way of thinking is literally just to finish that, and then just once we've done all that, we'll work out just, you know, an examination and an essay and a, you know, sloka. I'll try and work out which sloka. I'm not sure if I've given, I don't think I've given the sloka for the eighth canto yet, have I?
Yeah.
I have. Good. Then let us know next week. So, so we'll just push through. Yeah, okay? Yeah. Okay, John. Hare Krishna.